From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Fringe Science in the Pentagon. The new book, Imaginary Weapons, focuses on the Pentagon's quest to create a handheld superbomb that would have the impact of a nuclear weapon, but would use gamma rays. Most scientific experts were convinced the bomb would never work. We'll talk with the author, Sharon Weinberger. She's concerned that scientists are being marginalized in the process of reviewing weapons research. Weinberger edits Defense Technology International. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews It's All in the Game by tenor saxophonist Eric Alexander. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Sharon Weinberger is a journalist who covers national security and defense technology. Her new book, Imaginary Weapons, is about what she describes as fringe science in the Pentagon's scientific underground. It focuses on a Pentagon plan to build an isomer bomb, a grenade-sized superweapon so powerful it could melt human flesh, penetrate hardened underground bunkers, and evaporate whole city blocks. It would be unlike any other bomb ever made, using powerful bursts of gamma rays. But most scientists thought, and still think, it could never work. Weinberger is the editor of Defense Technology International. Several of her articles on fringe science in the Pentagon have been published in the Washington Post magazine. Sharon Weinberger, welcome to Fresh Air. I want to start by acknowledging that it's really hard for someone like me to tell the difference between fringe science and real science because the real science is so far out and beyond my comprehension. For example, what are some of the more far-out weapons being marketed now at military conferences that actually work or are really close to working that would seem really far out to most of us?
Well, certainly anything having to do with lasers or what's known in the field as directed energy is very far out. And this is something that's been under development for, well, about 40 years or longer and is only now coming to fruition. And that certainly was considered far out when the first lasers were developed in the 1960s. But at the same time, it wasn't considered fringe because the underlying science behind it was considered sound. And it was just the applications that were considered fringe. But what you point out is exactly correct. It's very, very hard for most people who don't have an in-depth scientific background to tell that difference between fringe and far out. And that's why in the United States, we have a science base which uses peer review by the scientific community to try to sort some of these things out.
And one of the points you make on this book is that peer review process is being allowed to or being forced to deteriorate?
I think particularly within the Pentagon, not in other parts of government so much, the National Science Foundation is very wedded to peer review, as is the National Institute for Health. But the Pentagon has historically taken a different approach. They call, particularly within the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, which is the research and development arm of the Pentagon, they take a high-risk, high-payoff view, that we might fund 100 projects and only one of them will pay off. But the payoff will be so high, it's worth the risk. But I think what a lot of people have noticed over the past couple decades is that as the scientific base within these agencies related to the Pentagon deteriorates, as the positions of scientific advisors are eliminated, and as there's less and less scientific capability within these agencies, there's less and less ability to determine what is high risk, high payoff, and what is foolish risk, no payoff.
Then there's a group called the JASONS, and there's a recent book that's all about the JASONS. Would you explain what the JASONS are?
The JASONS are a group that was formed in 1959, and they were kind of a child of the Manhattan Project, the next generation of scientists who really felt there was a need to provide scientific advice to the national security institutions, not just the Pentagon, but also other agencies as well. And they started off working on everything from ballistic missile defense and air defense studies and focusing very much on nuclear weapons, and then in later years branching off into other areas. And it was really kind of a unique phenomenon that you had scientists who were in academia who had top secret clearances providing completely independent advice to the Pentagon. And they were always walking a tightrope between not wanting to anger their sponsors and government, but at the same time wanting to provide scientific advice. And they were really an invaluable resource.
The JASONS fit into a story that you're about to tell about a bomb that was in development that a lot of scientists thought could never really happen and was an example of fringe science that shouldn't really be pursued or funded. And this is called an isomer bomb. Would you describe what the advocates of this bomb claim it would be able to do?
The advocates of what has been dubbed the isomer bomb claim you can take a radioactive material dubbed an isomer. It's sort of a charged up nucleus. One person described to me it's like a balloon filled up with air. And so in the concept of a bomb, if you take a balloon filled up with air, if you could find a pinprick to release all of this energy at once, that would be a bomb. And the idea of doing something useful with isomers has been around for years and years because they store all of this energy. They're highly energetic, and they're fascinating for physicists. And with any bomb, the idea is to get a lot of energy and then find a way to release it very, very quickly. And so isomers, kind of even to a layperson, if you describe it to them, it sounds like it would make a great bomb. Lots of energy and you can release it. And you get very, very, very close to nuclear levels of energy, very close to what a nuclear weapon would be. Only it's not, at least according to the letter of the physics laws, a nuclear weapon. So what you would be able to do is create bombs in very, very small packages. One of the concepts was a nuclear hand grenade. And though there's a lot of debate on the point, the argument is that you could even get around restrictions on nuclear weapons, both congressional restrictions on building new nuclear weapons and also moratoria on testing new nuclear weapons. And that's what makes the isomer bomb intriguing to the nuclear weapons laboratories and to the defense establishment.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Sharon Weinberger, and she's the author of the new book, Imaginary Weapons, A Journey Through the Pentagon's Scientific Underworld, and she is also the editor of Defense Technology International. Sharon, how were you first introduced to the idea of this isomer bomb?
Back in 2003, I was looking at writing a longer story on what are colloquially called bunker-busting nuclear weapons, the idea that we could hit underground targets with earth-penetrating nuclear weapons. And I was sort of intrigued by why people wanted to do this. So I was attending a number of briefings around Washington on the issue, and there was a nuclear weapons scientist giving a briefing on Capitol Hill. In the middle of the briefing, someone asked about something called a hafnium bomb. And I had absolutely never heard of this concept before, and a few people in the audience started chuckling and laughing like it was some inside joke. So I asked the gentleman who asked about it, what is a hafnium bomb? And it turned out that this was a scientist named Peter Zimmerman, who used to work in the old Arms Control and Disarmament Agency. And we sat down the next day, and he tried to explain what an isomer bomb was, and it was the most confusing thing. He introduced to me the idea of a nuclear isomer, which is a material that exists in a charged up state and stores a lot of energy. And he began to tell me the story of how in 1998, a Texas scientist named Carl Collins had gotten a hold of a sample of hafnium, this very radioactive material that had been bought by his wife's company. And then he used a used dental x-ray machine, shone it on the hafnium to trigger the energy. And lo and behold, about 5 years later, we have an entire Pentagon weapons project based around it. And the story seemed so outlandish and so far-fetched, I thought it couldn't possibly be true, only it was. So I began to trace the history of it. You know, how did this obscure experiment in Texas involving a radioactive material called hafnium and a used dental x-ray machine end up in the Pentagon? And the story I got out of that was the story of the hafnium bomb or the isomer bomb that I tell in this book.
Now this experiment with the dental x-ray machine releasing the energy of the hafnium, prominent scientists tried to replicate the results. What happened?
In 2000 and 2001, a group of scientists at the National Laboratories, which are owned and operated by the Department of Energy, about 12 of them got together and said, look, this, if it's true, has important implications for national security. We don't think it's true because it violates some basic laws of physics, but if it is true, it's very important. So let's do what we do in the scientific community. Let's try to replicate the results. So they did their own experiment using much better equipment and instrumentation. Rather than a dental x-ray machine, they used a massive x-ray facility. They prepared the hafnium sample in a very specific way. And they did one experiment at first and then published the results. Carl Collins, the Texas scientist who did the first experiment, said, oh no, they did this wrong, they did that wrong. So they went back a year later and they did another experiment to those specifications. And again, they found no results.
The Jasons were asked to examine this, and the Jasons are the panel of scientists, several Nobel Prize winners. So this panel of scientists whose job it is to evaluate technology like this, they were asked to examine the idea of the isomer bomb, the hafnium bomb. What was their consensus?
Their consensus of their study, which was done in 1999, was that, look, the initial results were improbable. We looked at the experiment, and there were several just outright flaws with the way the experiment was done. Not only does it violate the laws of physics, but as an experiment, there were lots of unknowns. There were things that weren't answered. They were very critical of the procedures that were used by the Texas group. And what they said was, well, we don't believe this. Perhaps it should be repeated at a better lab. But then they looked beyond the science of the experiment itself and looked at the possibility of the bomb, and they found a whole host of problems. They said, look, if you try to produce this radioactive material called hafnium, you're talking in the billions of dollars for the amount needed for a bomb. And we simply don't have the facilities to do this. They also saw other problems. If you look at the way a nuclear weapon works, you don't need just an initial spark of energy. You need a chain reaction. And no one knew how you would get a chain reaction with isomers. And they said simply looking over at the next 20 years, there's no threat of an isomer bomb being developed by other countries. There's no ability for us to do it in our country. And the whole thing is improbable. What they did do is leave open the door saying, let's repeat the experiment, which was exactly what was done by other groups who again found nothing.
So how is the project to build, you know, to fund the research to build this isomer bomb kept alive after, you know, projects failed to replicate the results? The panel of scientific experts, the Jasons, said that this was like really improbable and shouldn't be funded. How is the project kept alive after all that?
I think it has to do with an increasing interest and support for fringe science within the Pentagon as well as related agencies. That mainstream science or critics or skeptics like the Jasons or like other review boards are dismissed as being simply naysayers. What do they know? They don't know everything. They're just arrogant scientists. The other idea being forwarded by some in the scientific underworld is that there's this cabal of elder physicists who have a stranglehold on funding, who are only interested in funding their own projects or their colleagues' projects and are unwilling to look at new ideas. In essence, what they're arguing for is that the whole notion of peer review is flawed. And for many, particularly for a lay audience, this might be very compelling. It sort of appeals to the very American sense of being in love with the itinerant inventor, the sort of the rogue individual going against the mainstream. And there's nothing wrong with that romantic notion, but in science, particularly science that serves national security, this can be a recipe for disaster. If you're not willing to listen to the experts, you're going to pay the price, both the price of lost opportunities as well as pursuing projects like the isomer bomb that are not going to pan out. And increasingly in the Pentagon, you have a number of officials who are willing to continue on with these ideas, to fund them, and to simply not listen to the experts at all.
My guest is Sharon Weinberger. Her new book is called Imaginary Weapons. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Sharon Weinberger. She's the author of the new book, Imaginary Weapons, A Journey Through the Pentagon's Scientific Underworld. She's also the editor of Defense Technology International, and she's been covering defense technology for several years. In 2002, DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, started a project to try to develop a hafnium isomer weapon. Wasn't it DARPA that basically invented the internet, that basically designed the internet?
Yes, it is. DARPA has done just wonderful things over the years. The internet is probably the most famous example. It started off in DARPA as the ARPANET and eventually became the internet. And there are numerous examples of things that DARPA has done that have fed into mainstream science. The question that a lot of people are raising is the sort of, what have you done for me lately? Are we seeing DARPA on the decline? And I don't know that that's an easy answer. I do think there are concerning things going on with DARPA in terms of dismissing peer review. And the Jasons and their being removed from DARPA support and moved over to another part of the Pentagon may be a symptom of that.
Why do you think DARPA decided to take on further research to try to build this bomb?
Well, what happened was, is it first came to the director of DARPA's attention in 2002. You had a former Air Force scientist named Martin Stickley, who'd been interested in isomers for several years. And he had moved over to a new position at DARPA. And the way DARPA works is you get program officials who come in for 5 years, and they often bring in their pet projects. The DARPA website likes to describe their program managers as freewheeling zealots who will ignore everything in pursuit of their goals, and the idea being that they really like high risk. And that, in and of itself, is not a bad thing. In the case of this scientist, he came into DARPA and he went to the director and said, look, I have this great idea for a project I have. There's a scientist in Texas who claims to have these breakthrough results with isomers, and we think it would make for a really great explosive. And this really got the attention of the DARPA director, because this was 2002. It was still in the beginning stages of the war on terror. And there was a lot of interest in new sorts of weapons, new explosives, because we were looking at sort of the caves in Tora Bora in Afghanistan. We were looking at underground targets that might store weapons of mass destruction or leadership bunkers. So the idea of a new explosive was really very intriguing. Plus, another thing that it fed into at DARPA was the whole nuclear bunker buster debate. This has been a big push from this administration and from this Pentagon to develop these new nuclear bunker busters. But there's a lot of pushback from Congress and from the public on developing any new nuclear weapons. So what the isomer bomb presented to DARPA was a way around this. You could develop a new nuclear-type weapon that might be appropriate for the war on terror, but you can get around congressional restrictions, you can get around treaties, and it's something new. And this really was very appealing to DARPA in 2002 and to the Pentagon.
So what's the status of this research project at DARPA now?
DARPA has officially transitioned it out of the agency. In 2004, after I first published a cover story in the Washington Post magazine about the isomer bomb, Congress stepped in and said, look, this thing is a mess. You have tremendous scientific opposition to the program. And plus, we don't like the whole idea of developing a new type of nuclear weapon without congressional review of it. And they said it's too big and it's too much of a mess. At that point, the Pentagon was talking about spending upwards of $30 million and more just on the research stage, which is a lot of money for basic physics research. And so Congress ended the DARPA program, but allowed it to go on at a lower research level. And from what I understand, it was moved over to the Department of Energy. Congress earmarked a small amount of funds, well, small meaning about $5 million, for isomer production. And so there are still experiments that go on related to the hafnium bomb, but at a very, very low level. Beyond that, you still have isomer research, not in bomb applications, but in basic physics, that is sponsored by the Army and the Air Force. But one might argue that this is very legitimate research into just trying to understand isomers.
Los Alamos, which is a premier nuclear laboratory, was nearly taken over by Lockheed Martin, which is a defense contractor. How did that nearly happen? And what do you think it would have meant if the deal had gone through?
Well, all the nuclear weapons laboratories are owned by the Department of Energy, but operated by private contractors. Los Alamos, since its inception, like its sister lab, Lawrence Livermore, has been operated by the University of California. And there have been a lot of criticisms over the years of how the University of California has managed the lab. But there is, for the most part, among scientists, a consensus that being run by a university is really essential for a lab like Los Alamos that depends on science. The sort of university atmosphere pervades the place. The idea that, right or wrong, you will always be giving scientific advice to the best of your ability, that you're not serving a defense company. Sandia National Laboratory in New Mexico has been historically run by Lockheed Martin. And people say that Lockheed Martin is a good manager of it, but Sandia is not really, to the extent of Los Alamos, a science laboratory. In either case, these labs every so often are up for competition, and there had been so much criticism in recent years with things like the Wenho Lee scandal or missing computer disks that a lot of people thought that Los Alamos was really going to be given over to Lockheed Martin. And there were concerns that there would be mass retirements of scientists there who thought life under Lockheed Martin may be well managed, but it won't be independent. We will be working for a defense company that's involved in other large contracts. And how independent will we really be? Will we be able to contradict government on even issues like the hafnium bomb. And in that case, I think luckily for a lot of scientists, the lab was it did end up staying under the University of California, did not go to Lockheed Martin. But the trend has been in recent years to turn these laboratories over to private contractors.
Now that you've told us some of the story of attempts to do the research and then create this isomer bomb, what do you think are some of the larger issues that the story raises?
If you go back to the 1980s, something like the Challenger disaster, where we appointed a high-level panel and had the kind of iconic physicist like Richard Feynman looking at the Challenger accident, that was really, I think, an important point in history where a physicist was really able to explain to the American public what went wrong with the Challenger disaster. It was really a scientific issue, and we looked to scientists to help us solve these problems. I think today, increasingly, government turns to these scientific advisors less and less. Science is often looked at as simply a way to further a political agenda rather than sort of a check and balance on the types of things we're doing. I think the danger that I talk about in this book is not fringe science in and of itself. I wouldn't want this to seem like a clarion call to rally forces against fringe science. It's maybe perhaps a healthy thing that we have scientists out there interested in anomalous phenomenon and things that are far-fetched and maybe even outrageous. But unless government is willing and able to turn to scientific advice to help us decide what's real and what's not, we're going to see more and more imaginary weapons.
Sharon Weinberger is the author of Imaginary Weapons. She's the editor of Defense Technology International. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of The Art of War by Sun Tzu, in stores and online at bn.com. From the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the new Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan, information at moma.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, with a new website at macfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
That's tenor saxophonist Eric Alexander. Coming up, Kevin Whitehead reviews his new CD, It's All in the Game. And we continue our conversation with Sharon Weinberger about fringe science in the Pentagon. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Sharon Weinberger, author of the new book Imaginary Weapons, A Journey Through the Pentagon's Scientific Underground. It focuses on the Pentagon's attempt to create a superweapon that scientists warned could never work. Weinberger is the editor of Defense Technology International. Now, you know, your new book is about fringe science within the Pentagon and the defense technology community. What directions do you think the Bush administration has been heading in terms of weapons technology? Do you think they've been heading any more or less in the direction of fringy science?
I think they've certainly been heading in the direction of bad science, and with bad science often comes fringe science. One of the larger examples of that is missile defense. Not to say that everything under missile defense is fringe science or bad science, but once again, you have a large scientific community really criticizing a lot of the work that has gone on under the missile defense plan. And again, you have the Bush administration simply dismissing that advice and pushing it forward. In fact, a lot of the work that they've done on missile defense has been to take it out of even the normal reviews within the Pentagon and really isolate it from either scientific reviews or even programmatic reviews. But you can also see it in another area, for instance, the development of nuclear bunker-busting weapons. This has been another big push from the current administration, where they really want this new generation of nuclear weapons, these earth-penetrating bunker busters. We've developed bunker busters in the past. They're looking at developing a new one. And a number of scientific reviews have really criticized this concept, not saying you couldn't build one, but saying it would never do or be effective the way they want to use it. And these scientific reviews, like, for instance, the National Academy of Sciences review of it, have simply been dismissed or ignored.
What are their criticisms of the bomb?
There were a number of key criticisms of the bunker-busting bomb. One of the key ones was that the radiation would really be dispersed, that this would not be the sort of weapon that would burrow into the ground and take out an underground target, that there would be a lot of radioactive radiation that would go out with it, making it a very dangerous weapon to use the way the Pentagon wants to use it. The other problem is you have to sort of know what you're hitting. A fundamental dilemma of the bunker busting bomb is you have to know where the underground target is. And as we can see from our military conflicts in Afghanistan and Iraq, we often don't know where things are. And that's another big problem with trying to drop a nuclear weapon on something.
You know, the Bush administration has been criticized a lot by the science world for its attitude towards science, for its downplaying of global warming, for its open mind to intelligent design. And, you know, President Bush had said it should be taught in classrooms alongside evolution. So I'm wondering if you think its approach to defense technology science connects at all with its other science policies.
It's definitely part of the larger issue. I mean, the whole point of scientific advice is you have an idea, you have a policy, and maybe you want to see how well it falls in reality with science, and you turn to scientific advisors. What we're seeing on issues like global warming, like missile defense, like bunker-busting nuclear weapons, and maybe even by extension to the hafnium bomb, is you have a policy goal. And you're not interested in learning whether the science behind it pans out. You're only interested in the goal for the goal's sake. So either you seek out scientists who will tell you what you want to hear, or you simply ignore scientists completely. Unfortunately, I think this is an issue that goes beyond a little bit the current administration. One of the things that really riled the scientific community under Clinton Gore was when Clinton Gore first came in, the chief science advisor in the Department of Energy was summarily dismissed because he said on global warming, well, let's look at more of the evidence. And right or wrong, that didn't fall in with what was going on in the administration. He was dismissed. So it is, I think, particularly endemic in the current administration, but it's also something that goes back a number of years and that both Democratic and Republican administrations are prone to.
Let's talk a little more generally about weapons here. We've been testing new weapons in Afghanistan and Iraq. And one of the weapons you've written about that we've used for the first time in the war on terror is the thermobaric weapon. What is that and how have we used it?
Basically, thermobaric means high heat, high pressure. And the idea is, and it's not necessarily a new idea, though it's only recently used by the United States, it's a slow burn explosive. And the purpose of it is to hit something like a cave or a tunnel complex. And it sucks the air out slowly, creating a vacuum, essentially, to be blunt, incinerating everything inside and killing everyone inside. This was used actually by the Russians during their war in Afghanistan and also allegedly in Chechnya, and was very heavily criticized. The United States used their version of a thermobaric weapon for the first time in Afghanistan and claimed that it worked very well. What exactly that meant is not clear. But the idea is, you know, we're looking for new weapons that can hit these hard-to-reach targets, be they caves, be they complexes, or underground targets. One of the criticisms of something like the thermobaric bomb by human rights groups is it can often have very gruesome injuries. Since you're basically creating a vacuum, you can have a whole array of just very unpleasant injuries for people, along with death.
My guest is Sharon Weinberger. Her new book is called Imaginary Weapons. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Just joining us, my guest is Sharon Weinberger. Her new book is called Imaginary Weapons, A Journey Through the Pentagon's Scientific Underworld. She's also the editor of Defense Technology International. Your new book is about fringe science within the weapons technology industry. And you are the editor of Defense Technology International. As the editor of that, you probably get to see all kinds of fringe science proposals. Would you tell us about some of the more like far out proposals that have crossed your desk over the years, or that you've seen proposed at conferences?
Well, there's a number of examples. I think the most famous example is the intelligence agency's involvement with psychics. And this goes back to the Cold War and also to a little bit the problem of fringe science. Basically, the intelligence community during the Cold War found out that the Soviet Union was very interested in ESP, parapsychology, psychic phenomenon. And there was a concern that if the Soviet Union is paying that much attention to something within their science base, then maybe we should do it too. And so, sure enough, the United States began investing in psychics in a program that was based in part out of the old Stanford Research Institute, but it was funded by the Department of Defense, and basically looked at whether we can use psychics to help the military community. And they tried to do it with a veneer of scientific credibility. They tried to study the phenomenon, but it just gets to the point of the absurd. Can people sitting in darkened rooms really spot missile silos and submarines? And this went on for many years because it was classified. It was top secret. And so there was no scrutiny of it. There were no outside scientists available to say, look, we really need to look at this in a scientific manner. And it went on until 1995, when it was declassified. They had a scientific review of it. Some people said there's something there, some people said there's not. But look, you've been doing it for a long time. It's not coming to anything. Another example that comes to mind is the Tesla coil. The Tesla coil was invented over 100 years ago by Serbian inventor Nikola Tesla. And it basically shoots sparks a few feet. And every couple years at a defense conference, you'll find some itinerant garage inventor who comes up again with a Tesla coil. And it shoots sparks about a few feet. And he'll tell military officials, look, I can take this and I can make it shoot lightning bolts across the room. And the defense officials maybe don't know that this has been tried for a long, long time. It's really hard to shoot lightning across the room, but every few years they see this. It looks really cool because it shoots out sparks. And these sorts of lightning guns and Tesla coil weapons come up again and again.
You also write about a device that would be designed to transmit the voice of God into the enemy's head. What is that?
This is the idea that's colloquially called the voice of God weapon. It's also been around for a lot of years. Basically, back in the 1960s, if not sooner, I think the first published report was in the 1960s, scientists discovered that microwaves at a certain level can create an auditory effect. And this explained a lot. In World War II, engineers working with radars reported hearing clickings or buzzings, only not hearing them, but having them in their head. Scientists began to look at this, and one of the first published papers in 1961 said, look, there really is an auditory effect associated with microwaves. And immediately this raised the interest of defense officials who said, well, suppose we could create more than clicks or buzzes. Suppose we could make it voices and speak into people's head, make them think that God is talking to them or send messages, make them think they're crazy. And so colloquially, this is known as the voice of God weapon. And at the unclassified level, you've seen lots of small business contracts that have gone to small businesses that specialize in microwaves to see if you can create this weapon. The rumor has always been that there's been more research on this effect going on in the weapons laboratories. This is not fringe science in the sense that it may work or not work. It's fringe science in, I classify that because it's really one of these things that defense officials can't give up on because they think it sounds so good if we could, against insurgents, make a weapon that makes them think God is telling them to put down their arms. That would be a wonderful thing. Now, the problem is that, again, this is an idea that just never goes away. It's just too intriguing to be turned down.
What are some of the real weapons in the works now or about to be used that sound really far out but appear to actually work?
I think that laser weapons are really something that are coming of age. The military right now is investing in a solid-state laser that would reach up to 100 kilowatts. This is still a couple years away, though. The military hasn't been investing in laser weapons for 40 years, and the big problem with them is not creating the laser, and we know that lasers exist, we know how to make them, we can get them up to higher energy levels. The problem is making them so you can use them. Right now, we have one concept for an airborne laser. It's a chemical laser that would go on a Boeing aircraft, and it would fly around and shoot down ballistic missiles. They've had lots of problems with this. The laser itself can shoot, but you need to integrate it. You need to make it into a weapon. It needs to go on an airplane. At the very lower level, I think some of the first laser weapons that we'll see are going to probably be solid-state lasers. They've made a lot of progress. They can be made smaller, but even that's a couple years away. But a couple years is a lot better than the 40 years we've been working on other lasers.
The Army is buying Chinese-made lasers designed to blind the enemy. And I think one of the uses they want to put it to is to prevent suicide bombers from rushing checkpoints. Is it controversial for us to be buying weapons technology from China?
Very. This is an interesting issue that's been kind of gurgling up in the defense establishment over the past few months and is really only now getting some play in the press. One of the most sort of realistic uses of lasers are very, very lower energy lasers that can be used to blind an enemy. This technology has been around for years. I mean, even a laser pointer shown at someone is, you know, people may block their eyes to block the beam. The problem with this has always been getting it through. The Pentagon actually does have a very rigorous review board for the use of lasers on humans. And there's international treaties that they have to abide by, and then there's internal regulations. And the controversy that has come up lately is that if you say, I have a laser that will be used to temporarily blind the enemy, it goes by one set of standards. But if you say, I'm not using this on people's eyes, I'm using this on a rifle, as a rifle pointer, then it goes under a separate set of standards. But the issue at hand in Iraq is that these lasers are likely being used for both. They're being used as pointers, but also to designate, to put a spot on something, but also used to block the eyesight of an enemy. And that creates a real issue of whether these are going through the rigorous standards that we have in the Defense Department. But these things are real. They're being deployed. They can be used to temporarily blind an enemy as well as a pointer. And these things exist.
But what about the controversy of buying it from China?
That issue has been that basically the U.S. has been in recent years flooded by very cheap Chinese-made lasers, and Customs has created a whole list of Chinese companies that are shipping these lasers that don't meet our safety standards, but inevitably some come through. There was a specific controversy in recent months where the one of the Army labs was putting together one of these laser pointer systems and started using Chinese components. And when questioned about it, they said, well, look, these are cheaper. You know, we'll let someone else worry about the standards of whether they're safe or not safe. That's not our job. We're just building the system, and we're going to use whatever's cheapest. And this was really a concern because in defense shows a few years ago, the Chinese actually marketed a product that was defined, that was specified for blinding an enemy. And it really was above any medical safety threshold. It would have caused permanent blindness. And China was really heavily criticized in Congress for marketing this. And now you have U.S. companies as well as U.S. military laboratories buying these same components from China, but saying, well, they're cheaper. And also, these aren't really meant for blinding. They're just meant for designating.
You have been writing about defense technology for several years. You deal with the science behind it, with the funding of it, with the issues behind it. You know, one of the things you say in your book that I thought was very interesting, you say journalism has never dealt well with science because its emphasis is on balance. I mean, journalists are really proud of emphasizing balance. Well, why do you see that as a problem in your field, in your part of journalism?
It's a problem when you write about a field that doesn't rely on balance. Balance is a wonderful thing. Objectivity is a wonderful thing. But how do you use that balance when you're writing about a field that doesn't want balance? They want scientific consensus. And that's a challenge that I think is very hard to resolve. The scientific community doesn't say, we're going to look at cold fusion and say one scientist says cold fusion is right, one scientist says cold fusion is wrong. What the scientific community says is, look, we're going to look at this the way the community works at it. We'll do a series of experiments. If they don't replicate, we may not accept it. If better results come around one day, we'll look at it again. So the problem is that you get this phenomenon within journalism out of the best of intentions, that every few years, one of these anomalous phenomena that are very popular, like cold fusion, reappears in the press. And the challenge for journalism is how do you look at it? A scientist comes forward and says, look, I have a cold fusion result. And so then you go to one scientific expert who says cold fusion is impossible. But the first scientist you interviewed says it is possible. And so you write both, and these articles appear every couple of years and say, cold fusion is back, maybe it's possible, maybe it's not. And these sorts of articles enrage the scientific community because they say, look, we don't look at cold fusion anymore because it doesn't meet our scientific standards of consensus, of reproducibility. So I think the role of journalism in this and how we do it better is that we shouldn't lose our objectivity. We shouldn't lose our balance. What we need to work harder at is explaining the way the scientific method works and the way the scientific community works, and explaining that the scientific community is very harsh, but it's very harsh for a reason. If you let every result come through, we would never make any progress. We would still be stuck in the age of alchemy trying to make lead into gold.
Sharon Weinberger, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Sharon Weinberger is the author of Imaginary Weapons. She's also the editor of Defense Technology International. Coming up, Kevin Whitehead reviews a new CD by tenor saxophonist Eric Alexander. This is Fresh Air. Tenor saxophonist Eric Alexander passed through the Seattle and Chicago jazz scenes on his way to becoming a New Yorker over a decade ago. He's recorded a couple of dozen albums, but jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says many jazz fans have yet to notice how good he really is. Here's Kevin's review of Alexander's latest CD.
Eric Alexander jump-starting his version of Rodgers and Hart's ballad, Where or When. Some jazz musicians win you over by being suave, by caressing a melody. Alexander tears into a nice tune like Popeye into a can of spinach with the same explosive results. Playing or improvising on a song, he'll lean into the beat, impatient to get moving. A favorite ploy is to bounce one note between octaves or alternate between two ways of fingering the same note, so he jogs in place like a runner at a stoplight. Eric Alexander with former teacher and frequent partner Harold Mayburn on piano. Nat Reeves is on bass and Joe Farnsworth on drums. When the saxophonist was coming up in the 90s, his other mentors included the great tenor players Von Freeman and George Coleman. But neither's as obvious a role model as John Coltrane, with his big, noble tone all over the horn, lightning quick articulation, and a buzzsaw approach to ballads. Those alternate fingerings and a weakness for nervous trills help pull Alexander out of Coltrane's shadow. Here he is on Monk's ballad, Ruby, My Dear. Alexander, this fireworks show can't be the conceptual triumph it was for Coltrane, but it's still a win for dazzling technique. On Eric Alexander's new album, It's All in the Game on High Note, the excitement may flag when the pace does. The most notable change-up is a bossa nova-ish take on the 1971 Roberta Flack Donny Hathaway hit, Where is the Love? Alexander finds a bluesy undercurrent below a slick surface. As a post-1960 pop song recorded by a jazz musician, Where Is the Love is one of those tunes mislabeled new standards by some jazz folk. A real standard, new or otherwise, is a tune that dozens or hundreds of jazz musicians play, part of a shared repertoire. By that measure, none of the Monkees or Bjork or Radiohead songs covered by a jazz musician or two is a bona fide standard, although the Beatles' Blackbird is on the way. Not that good players like Alexander shouldn't play pop music of the last 40 years. Still, the speed drills bring out his best. It's a thrill to hear someone so confident at high velocity who doesn't exhaust his ideas even while rifling through them in a hurry. As far as I'm concerned, Eric Alexander can play anything he wants. But maybe he could play it really fast.
Kevin Whitehead teaches English and American Studies at the University of Kansas, and he's a jazz columnist for eMusic.com. He reviewed It's All in the Game by tenor saxophonist Eric Alexander. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Ian Chilog, Patty Luswing, Sam Brigger, and Jonathan Menhivar. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org, and from Carnegie Corporation of New York, a foundation created by Andrew Carnegie to promote the advancement and diffusion of knowledge and understanding. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Mary Cheney. Her new memoir is about working in her father's vice presidential campaigns and how she reconciled working for the ticket in spite of President Bush's opposition to gay marriage. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.